it's the narrative game. So it's the Bitcoin game, which is playing the 1,000-year narrative, and the meme coin game is playing the 2-day narrative or the 24-hour narrative. And if you catch the right one, like, it's, I guess there's an analogy there for all sorts of investing too, right? It's like people identifying things that they think are gonna change the world over the course of their family's lifetime versus something that you think more people are gonna find funny tomorrow. Therefore, there's gonna be more attention on it. Therefore, there might be more energy and money directed towards it. Therefore, you might be able to ride that trend a little bit.
All right, welcome to another episode of Not Investment Advice. We got Trunk Fan, Jack Butcher, Bilal Zaidi. What's going on, boys? It's a mad, mad week. Bitcoin is just hitting all-time highs again. We talked about it on the pod last week, but we're finally hitting it. What was it? 68 point something?
Is maybe that a chair just you're sitting on, Trunk?
I'm back down. I am back. For long-time listeners, they're running. I mean, I haven't been getting messages actually for a bunch of people. It's hysterical. They're like, Trunk, are you sitting down? What's going on? I've been sitting, people. For the people that have been listening, like just on the audio side, I've been sitting. We've been... I pushed out. I pushed out people.
You got to do it. Well, now when it hits 69,
I'm allowed to, right?
You're going to have to stand now until 100K or whatever the next laser eyes is.
Hello, Jack's like, are you sitting down? Yeah, I'm sitting in this Herman Miller gaming chair. Herman Miller, H-E-R-M-A-N dash M-I-L-L-E.
/Trunk. Trunk fan. For no discount. You get zero discount if you follow that. You probably to a broken page as well. It doesn't even work.
Yeah. Oh my God. If you go to HermanMiller.com/Trunk, it's a dead URL.
It doesn't work. And they need to get your Trunk chair there, man.
Yeah, but
it's only a standing chair.
Well, anyway, I'm just going to say this, and I want you guys to cook. Twitter is so much better when the crypto is booming, dude. It's just, unreal.
Not just
man.
Twitter, basically everything. To
everything
be honest,
is
this
better.
Podcast, the group chats, life, everything has been better in the last week, man. I mean, I have to say, the level of jokes and the memes going around and just the energy is definitely back. Like, you know, we're going to talk about meme coin season today. All the edge of the internet stuff we were kind of known for when we started the pod 2021 popping off. We're going to bring some of that back today. Just Jack's going to share some stuff he's been looking at. And then we're going to talk about MicroStrategy Sailor, what he's been doing, how Bitcoin eats the equity market, or more specifically, Trunk's going to say how MicroStrategy
can eat
the equity
market. Yeah, there's a crazy, super speculative article about how like MicroStrategy can basically take over the entire S&P 500. I mean, there's a logic chain to it, but anyways, continue.
So does Sailor's, everything Sailor says has some logic chain to it. If you've got a really long chain that's made of some funny stuff.
If you chain together 1,000 chains and you don't look at every single thing closely, it all kind of like makes sense.
Exactly. And then we're going to talk about Elon suing OpenAI. There's some interesting stuff there. And if we get to it, we'll talk about Make It of Dune. Because Dune 2 is out, I think, or coming out, whatever.
Dune 2's out, yeah.
Dune 2's out. So, boys, how do we start? We got a meme of the week, yeah? This is...
Yeah.
I'm going to share my screen. This is a Jack special. Jack shared this, and I haven't actually seen it, so let's...
So, but hold on. I just want to tee this up, is when things are popping off, like, Jack always sends us... So, Jack, I don't know what's going on in Jack's timeline. Jack Butcher has the most insane X timeline. The weirdest shit pops up on there. He just drops it in our group chat and we're like wheezing. So he found this video. It's one of those interstellar memes of Matthew McConaughey crying, watching a video. But this one is of him crying, watching Michael Saylor. We'll play a couple like 30 to seconds or 60 seconds of it. But it's hysterical. It's about the Michael Saylor second best meme. Go ahead.
All right, perfect. I'm going to press play here.
So for listeners, Matthew McConaughey's turning on a video. Okay.
What's the second best? There's no second best. There's no second best crypto asset. There's a crypto asset. It's called Bitcoin, right? Right? There's no second best.
The grin.
Okay? It's not like Google and Facebook. It's not like Apple and Amazon.
The music as well, the background.
Apple or Amazon, what's better? They both look like tech monopolies to me. They both look pretty good. On the other end, Bitcoin or... No, Bitcoin. Bitcoin's crypto asset.
Dude, I'm crying. Like there are tears in my eyes right now. I'm crying like McConaughey. Bro.
It's not 6.5.
All right, this goes on for 2 minutes, bro, but man, there we go.
There's literally a tear coming down my eye right now. That's how good that edit is. Bro.
Edit was clean as well. Even the TV, the angle of it, they did very well there. That's an advanced crop, you know what I mean? But crazy times,
yeah, that's
man.
Meme of the week. So why don't we walk through what's going on? Let me just add one thing that I missed off before Jack cooks on the meme coins. So Bitcoin passed all-time highs. We're doing Wednesday recording. It did it, I think, Tuesday morning. And then it crashed by 10%, but it looks like it's back up now. Listen,
the standard 10% drop.
Yeah, you know, if you're trying to time crypto, come on, you're going to get bodied, right?
I was surprised it was only 10. I was expecting a 20, 30% drop. Like 30% near the all-time high, normally there's a little bit of a
resistance.
Yeah,
when it hit last time,
there.
Right, it fell like 50% in like a month. Here but the one difference that I did see was that Ethereum, last time Bitcoin hit 69, Ethereum was at 4,900. But this time it's only at 3,900. I don't know. People are like speculating, like, "What's going on?"
There, but
not investment advice. Well, what? Why is that happening? But anyways, maybe
but that normally
answers.
Happens, though, right? Like, there's normally like Bitcoin normally goes first, ETH normally goes second. Again, this
not investment advice.
Yeah. Also, like things could not be the same as the past, and then there's normally
also
altcoin
only one.
Season after that. But interestingly, this time Bitcoin's been really pumping. ETH's gone up, but is. Off the all-time high a little bit more, but then we've had all these meme coins really popping off, right? So we're going to talk about that. I will just call out Will Clemente shared this yesterday. Coinbase had its highest day of trading volume of all time today, which was Tuesday, March 5th, and Bitcoin hasn't even closed above all-time highs. Fee revenue go burst, so much for the ETFs rendering them obsolete. So yeah, very interesting. I mean, have you guys felt anything like that? Because that obviously is retail, right? Like that is, you know, people picking up their phone. Probably a lot of people getting that ping, like Bitcoin is going up this much. My girlfriend was saying Dogecoin was up because we were saying we're talking about the meme coin stuff today. So have you guys felt much even in the last week versus the few weeks before that?
Of what?
Defer to Jack.
Just like people reaching out, people asking you questions or anything like the
maybe
the
a little
general,
bit,
like your parents or anything like that.
Maybe a little bit monocracy. Yeah, my parents were here this week and that like they're getting a few headlines, but it's still, yeah, it's different. That like the institutional slant on it is so much different. Like the amount of capital that they're sloshing around that doesn't require. Everybody with a phone to be participating to move it feels different. Yeah. Who knows though? Like, and underestimating this stuff is fascinating as well because it doesn't take more than a day for basically everybody in the world to know about anything significant, right? To imagine that there's like some delay between this information becoming available is quite naive, but
well, you know, when to Jack's
not
point,
speculate.
When Bitcoin dropped 10%, you know Larry Fink was backing up the Brinks truck. Yeah, our boy Fink was just on his phone putting in a $1 billion buy order.
Seriously,
unbelievable.
Yeah. So, I guess
he'll be back.
Yeah. So, I think you brought up a good point there, Jack, about the institutional thing is one big, really different thing here, and I know we talked about it. I think last week or the week before. And you guys see on Twitter, on X, people sharing the inflows coming from the 11 different ETFs, BlackRock, X amount, you know, all the other ones coming in. And it's in the billions of dollars. It's breaking records, all that sort of stuff. So that is an interesting idea because a lot of the time, traditionally, Jack, you would know this as well, just from operating in the space, like there's all these people that have bought Bitcoin from 2010, 11. Then when 2017 happened, those people were spending it on all sorts of different stuff, trying to chase a bag. Then the 2017 people were chasing it in 2021. We had NFTs. We had kind of this excess liquidity going elsewhere. And the interesting thing is here, there are some people saying this time it may be different in a way because when you're buying an ETF, you're not necessarily then selling that ETF to buy a meme coin. You're like, they're not exactly this. It's not like selling in Coinbase and buy this other thing that's gone up at a higher rate. So what's this? Who shared this? This is coin.
This is just like spot market data volume here.
Yeah.
Mental.
What, when it, oh, so this is, oh, okay, great. Wow. Look at that massive sharp increase.
Volume per day. What's that? Yesterday, $260 billion of volume in the crypto market, which is what?
Near the peak is basically what you're saying, right? It's like almost like the
in terms of volume.
Peak.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's just so violent compared to like these previous builders, right? Obviously, this stuff is inherently like volatile as anything, but just insane. Like what this actually unlocks in terms of and like the fidelities of the world publishing, they're like, yeah, we recommend 3% of your portfolio to be in
it's wild.
Yeah, insane.
That is unprecedented, right? Like thing, that's very different from last time around, from 2021.
I think it's just it's actually mental to think of it, because I don't know, Trung, maybe you have good context on this, because these ETFs, the one thing that was downplaying the significance of them was like, oh, you can get it in Canada or Australia or something. It's the capital markets in Canada and Australia are like inconsequential in comparison, right?
Not just in size, but in
influence.
Just absolute minnows compared to the US. You can get it in Canada, Australia. It'd be like you're a fan of basketball, being like, oh, yo, let's go to the high school basketball game. Like, completely inconsequential. LeBron, high school basketball game, right? It's like, it's just a totally different world.
And now, narrative and just straight up access to capital is crazy. You saw, was it Vanguard said they were going to block the purchasing of the any of the ETFs for protection of their customers? CEO just stepped down last week.
After a long time, he's like an OG.
The exposure you have to like that, like PR downside after that is quite enormous.
A lot, because they were one of the few. I mean, they kind of have run the ETF market for a while. I mean, Trung, you know the numbers better.
Yeah, the guy, what's his name? I'll Google it. Right,
is it Bogle?
Yeah, Bogle.
Yeah, because they call them Bogleheads, right? Like in personal finance world, yeah. Go on, Jack.
Well, isn't it? I mean, it's kind of fascinating how that it almost runs completely counter to the philosophy on which they founded their business on, right?
Yeah.
Which it makes sense why they would reject it. It's like, oh, you can have fractional ownership of a quote unquote value producing company that ticks boxes X, Y, and Z, but this just stands in opposition to a lot of those ideas. It's a very different asset. But at the same time, over the years, I'm sure they've given their customers the option to buy things that have performed incredibly poorly, like not even on a
volatile
comparable.
Things.
Oh, I'm sure they've offered them the biggest dog shit ETFs in the world, right? Or the SPACs,
Yeah. And so just to clarify, they were one of the... one of the providers who kind of rejected it. And now, I use Vanguard. A lot of people use Vanguard. And I was like, oh, I want to see if I can buy some in my 401k or my Roth or whatever. And I was like, oh, wait, I don't even have this. This is like a few weeks ago or like a month ago. And lots of people were sharing on Twitter and X, sending an email to them, being like, hey, we want this in our account. If not, I'm moving to Fidelity or whoever else is actually offering it. So how much of that do you think was related to him leaving? Trung, you probably follow that world a bit more than we do, but just because he's been there a long time, right? Like, I don't think he's necessarily retiring because of this one thing.
But I'm here to feed the narrative. I'm saying it as entirely irresponsible.
It's 100% the reason.
Wait, let me actually
convened.
Do a quick...
Let
me see what the press... Let me see what the messaging was. Why don't you ask
leaving?
Jack about the... actually, before we get into that... before the meme coins, let me actually say one thing that I have been looking at, which is kind of, I didn't think about it last cycle, but it's making more sense now with the fidelities of the world that you guys all kind of mentioned here. So these premiums that these stocks are getting, right? So like Nvidia's whatever trading at 50 times earnings, big tech's trading at 20 to 30 times earnings, right? It's a lot of that premium, if you think about the world, like this is a CFA style.
And Nvidia is 74, right?
Okay,
75.
So 74 times
ratio,
earnings, right?
Yeah.
So like as an investor, you're paying 74 times, basically a dollar of earnings, you're paying 74 times for that, right? And if you're looking at the pie of your investments, we all do this, right? Some of us have more money in cash, real estate, just leave it in a, maybe a fixed income asset that's giving you 4-5% a year.
Cryptodes.
Yeah, cryptodes. But like yeah, exactly. Truly this idea that Fidelity is putting out there, which Jack, you mentioned the 3% number that they're like bandying about. I do not think you can underestimate how crazy this is, because a lot of the equity premium, a lot of the reason why you're paying 74 times earnings, why people are paying 20 times or 25 times the S&P 500 for a dollar of earnings, is because there's just been this decade-long understanding, basically from the 70s, that equities is where you can put money, it will grow over X amount of years, right? You go to any bank right now, and then you'll have your normal bank representative. You know how they always have the chart ready, right? How many times have you been hit by that chart? Here's the S&P over the last 50 years. Yeah, it goes up and down, but it's always up. Like every time I've gone to a bank, they've hit me with that exact chart. So that meme of stocks is where you go to preserve buying power has been so powerful for 50 years now. And it's been like smashed into our domes. But prior to the 70s, that wasn't the thing. You know, people would be like, oh, fixed income assets. You know, interest rates were much higher at the time. You put your money in fixed income assets. And then that boosted the value of fixed income. So the mind shift to actually thinking that Bitcoin and Ethereum are things where you should just put money and it won't get destroyed in 20, 30 year timelines. You're talking about a wave of capital. It's almost unimaginable how much that means, right? And that, when people start throwing around numbers where, oh, Bitcoin will hit $1 million a coin, that's kind of, in my mind, where I'm like, that's, it's kind of insane, but not really. If you think about that argument, which is coming more into fruition because of the Fidelities. I don't know if you guys have any thoughts on that.
Jack, anything, mate?
Yeah, I mean, obviously I've been bought into the Saylor thesis for a long time. But you know what else I think is interesting about the, like, there's like the I don't even know how to describe this, but the very act of these institutions offering this changes the consensus around it on a different level, where gold, for example, has value because of our collective agreement over hundreds of years that it's a, like, this very, very hard to destroy thing, hard to get. Yeah, thousands, apologies. That the, like, ability to buy that through an institution that is designed to protect your wealth is now incentivized to protect the narrative around that thing. And that to me is also interesting around, like, all the political context of this, where it's like BlackRock offers this as a product. Yes, it is not necessarily the cypherpunk's dream of how Bitcoin adoption was going to get accelerated. But at the same time, there's an argument to be made for, like, yeah, if the biggest asset manager in the world validates this as an asset class, the narrative around it just naturally, like, if you have pension funds buying this thing, it becomes this consensus game where it's like, yeah, this has to keep its value because we have agreed among us and we have this much. It's like, what do they call it? Foregone conclusion. Or it's just like this runaway train.
Oh, self-fulfilling.
Of
self-fulfilling
prophecy. That's what I was trying to get to. Yeah. And there's, like, I think the reason why the Saylor narrative gains so much traction too is, like, people just gravitate towards this idea of certainty, you know, like anything you can do to get closer to quote unquote certainty has this, like, incredible base level appeal. And this by design has that, you know, like, I think so many people get to a, you know, like a much deeper level of appreciation, shall we call it, for this, because it operates at more of a philosophical level than an Nvidia, for example, where, like, yes, it's decades and decades of incredible technical innovation, but if another
chip manufacturer, another graphics card manufacturer came out and started doing it better, you'd happily move your money over. You know, like Bitcoin is part technology and part like
meme.
Yeah, meme, philosophy, like everything has that memetic component to it, but it's like a literal, like people are writing books about its impact on the future of interplanetary civilization, right? And the people aren't writing
doing like, 8-hour long NVIDIA podcasts about goats on a mountain and how that leads to Bitcoin. Yeah, exactly.
Exactly, because there's that's a good way fundamental set of characteristics that are different than, hey, there's these bunch of really smart people in this place that are fulfilling a market's desire for something right now. No, this is a completely new like accounting system for everything and store of value. And, you know, from first principles, I'm not as eloquent as Michael Saylor, but everything ladders up to that. And yeah, it doesn't hurt having like a spokesperson like that too. I think the effect that he personally has had on the adoption of this stuff, from like the Tesla balance sheet stuff to converting MicroStrategy's treasury to bit like that stuff, was like, those are all the steps that led to a BlackRock level acceptance of this thing, right? It's like it's integrated into what one would think of as mature finance, the S&P, yeah, except because people have been trying to get a Bitcoin ETF approved for
years,
10 years, I think. I think they were like Winklevoss brothers were trying to get it done.
Yeah, I think they were the first one to, or they were the early people, back. Yeah.
They're like, that's it's not serious.
Yeah.
But now it's serious.
Jack, I think what you're saying there is like the narrative around it as well. And I think when we talked about it, is the first, well, the last bull run 2021, if let's just take ourselves back to that. We're coming out of a global pandemic, very low interest rates, right? Money was basically free. High inflation or getting high. And there was an argument that all of this was just a low interest rate phenomenon or zero interest rate phenomenon, right? And that's actually an interesting change here where, and I will be consistent with that logic, stocks are also at all-time highs, right? So it's not just out of nowhere, the only thing that's high is cryptocurrency. But that is an interesting thing here. And Trung, I don't know if you've got, I mean, both of you, but Trung, you might have some thoughts on this, because I know you talked to, what was his name, Stan Druckenmiller, around that time and asked him about some of this stuff. And I remember listening, I remember just like when the pandemic happened and stocks were going at all-time highs, and I was just like, wait a minute, this doesn't make any sense. And because I, you know, I didn't know much about it, and when I learned more, I realized, okay, there's a difference between the economy and the stock market and what's actually happening today versus what's projected for the future, and liquidity and all the different things that can impact obviously interest rates as well, that can impact the markets. So curious to hear your guys' take on that as well, because that is different this time. Yeah, go on, Jack.
Well, I was just going to say before Trung, like the correlation between the all-time high in the stock market and all-time high of Bitcoin is about the denominator, where it's like everything is getting repriced because the dollar is worth less, right? Michael Saylor clip, the dollar's value is going to...
Raph, I think you can throw it in. Actually, maybe not today because we haven't got time, in. But yeah, maybe throw it in, but yeah.
The money lost 99.5% of its value over 80 to 90 years. Mm-hmm. And if you back calculate the real loss of purchasing power against a market basket of scarce assets of the U.S. dollar, you conclude that we're really inflating the currency 7 to 8% a year, every year for 100 years.
Everybody's seen the chart of the, like, you know, the shit coin purchasing power going to the, which again gets to this fundamental philosophical conversation at the bottom of this, where it's like, okay, if your stake in company X is worth this much, but 2 years ago, that amount protects less of your purchasing power than it does now, that doesn't mean shit, right? And if both of those things are true, then these two things are going up in parallel forever. But they're like
together,
there's a relationship
correlated.
Between
yeah,
like,
they're correlated.
Yeah.
But I don't know what the direct question was regarding.
I was asking about the fact that this has changed from what some people would say was a zero interest rate phenomenon, just liquidity in the market, things were going up, Whereas now, like, this is a different environment versus, let's say, 3 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, I think, there's still a lot of money out there. That's the other thing,
right? That's
true, yeah. There's still a lot of money out there. And, but you're right. I think the main point is that it's 69. What was the drawdown? 70%. And now it's back, right? In a objectively higher interest rate environment. And the and now with, as we just talked about, institutional green light, it is just a totally different ball game.
Sounds like a resilient asset to me. It's the
some of the Larry Fink like direct quotes, I think he's talking about like the devaluation of state money, right? Pretty sure that's he's on the record saying that too. Sorry, carry on.
No. I think we should get into the meme coins now. Jack can give us some engineering and stuff.
I want to talk about it. Just last thing I want to say on that is there were also rumors of a sovereign wealth fund buying Bitcoin. Did you guys see there was again, this is complete speculation, I think, but what's the guy from El Salvador? I forgot his name. I can't say his name, but the guy.
Bukele.
Yeah. He was meeting like the Qatari folks. This is a few months ago. And I think Max Kaiser, is his name Max Kaiser? He's a Bitcoin Maxi guy who does a lot of funny stuff at those conferences. But he had posted it's happening, reposting this thing from several months ago. Again, I don't know if that's complete speculation or what, but I've heard a few other people say they've heard rumors that there has been a sovereign wealth fund.
Size, right?
In size, exactly. And so anyway, I don't know if you guys heard anything about that, but if not, we can move on from it. But I think that is an interesting thing as well, because we've had the country do it, but not, this is not like France bought it, right? Like this is El Salvador, with all due respect. It's easier to dismiss El Salvador on an international stage than it is a France or a US or Canadian government or whatever. But a sovereign wealth fund doing it would also be kind of another layer. So, but let's talk about things they probably aren't buying, which is meme coins. So what has been going on here, boys? Because I did say earlier that normally the pattern is Bitcoin goes, ETH goes, then there's altcoin season, there's NFT season we had last time. But this time it's gone very quickly. And I'm just on CoinMarketCap right now, and they have a whole category just for memes. So we've got Dogecoin, Shiba Inu, Pepe, Bonk, Dog, Whiff Hat, which has been a massive winner over the last few weeks. A bunch of these kind of like funny meme coins. What's been going on here? Any ideas, Jack?
I think a lot of it is like it's been going on for a long time, obviously Doge and Shiba and all that stuff from however many cycles ago that was.
Yeah.
My like real memory of when it like when started to like really kick off again was like Q4 last year. It was like, like a little quieter on the major front, and then like people just looking for stuff to do, and speculation moves elsewhere. I also think the Solana ecosystem has done a massive amount for just growing this area of crypto because of the more cost to transact and move in and out, and just like the fees to use the chain. Like,
yeah,
this completely. Stuff was on Ethereum, prior to. The Solana ecosystem, I don't know a ton about since like prior to the last 6 months or so, but so many people since like the dark cloud of the SBF, attachment to that ecosystem, there's so many people building great stuff on there, amazing tools. There's like great, vocal people on Twitter explaining a lot of pieces of the Solana ecosystem. I should share some of those. But the frictionless nature of it just lends itself to this stuff popping up in real time, right? Where there's a trend on Twitter or there's a funny thing that happens and somebody makes basically a parallel instrument
in which you can participate in the growth of that trend and meet people and mess about on Twitter doing that. And some of them have just reached like ridiculous exit velocity. The dog with hat is what?
Dog with hat.
Yeah.
Wait, Jack, when you say low friction, you're saying literally just spinning something up.
Yeah.
Like, how quickly can this happen?
Yeah, which is true on Ethereum.
Yeah.
Which is true on Ethereum, but it's cost. It's like,
because like a transaction could cost $90 on Ethereum mainnet, like the layer one. Whereas obviously there was Polygon, Arbitrum, all those things, Optimism we've talked about. If I'm saying the name wrong, the wrong names, because it's kind of rusty for me, but that was the layer two stuff where you could do things cheaper on Ethereum. But to me, Solana has just become, like I wrote a bullet point here, Solana taking ETH mindshare, like, because it, from my perspective, as someone who doesn't do that much, especially in the NFT space, I could see people who were very vocal, big, in air quotes, Web3 people with NFT stuff in the last go around, now being like, well, we're doing it on Solana this time. And there's, look at this, what's happened on Solana. And so there's been a bit of a fragmentation there. And kind of what you said earlier, Trung, or one of you said that around the certainty. I can't remember.
Jack.
Who's, Jack said that, sorry. That's an interesting thing for Ethereum. And, you know, last time round, all this stuff was happening on Ethereum, like DeFi, ENS, like the .eth names we had. Now you're seeing 3-4 years later, a lot of that's, there's also the Solana version of that. There's even a Bitcoin version of that, which we'll come to in a bit. You know, the kind of layer twos, like stacks we talked about in the past. And I think you're going to talk about ordinals, which I know nothing about. So there is a bit of an interesting thing here for the Ethereum ecosystem, in my eyes, as an outsider, really, to say you kind of owned all that mindshare and now it's kind of fragmenting a little bit. And that's kind of a risk in a way for Ethereum ecosystem.
Hold on, let me jump in here quickly. Is like, so Jack, before you show dog with hat, I just, the fact that I just
ridiculous
said,
name, yeah.
Dog, what is the market cap of dog with hat?
2 billion.
I don't even know. And so how long has it been around?
Since November, I think.
Okay, basically, is this that much different than the altcoin situation a couple of years ago? Or is it just, like you said, Solana, much lower friction, much lower transaction fees? So these things happen so fast. And then the addendum to that would be this. Is this actually creating anything? Because the criticism, the last cycle, was just like, what is this? It's all this is gambling, which I just want to make clear, it's totally fine. Like, how big is the fantasy sports gambling industry, right? A deca-billion-dollar industry. So I have no problem with this being another offshoot of that, but is it all this is? So that's my question.
Well, I mean, there's definitely that component to it. It's also like it shares a lot of characteristics with all of the like permissionless network formation stuff. That's why this stuff is like forming around memes, you know, like people making stuff on Twitter and feeling like they can build the network, get like more people involved in this thing. So it does like, it does create these communities of people in the short term. And yeah, but for sure it's like, I heard this term coined the other day, financial nihilism. Like, these are all symptoms of people perhaps being in situations where, you know, the pathways to a financial situation that you once were looking for are not as visible to you as they may have been to generations prior. So it seems like an obvious evolution of behavior. I think this is like a...
Chasing the pump, basically.
Well, let me give a very specific example of Jack's financial nihilism. If you go to any gas station, you see people buying lottery tickets, right? And like, I don't want to code certain individuals, but it's very clear to me what income class is buying those lottery tickets, the majority of them. I mean, it's very well known that, I mean, we've talked about it here. Lotteries are a tax on the lower class because the government gets revenue from those lotteries. And the reality is that they're buying them out of proportion to the rest of the population, right?
Yeah. Well, here's a different...
Go ahead, Jack.
Well, here's a different frame and an interesting frame that I've heard too is like the lack of friction in this stuff and the like institutional acceptance of it at the high end is a massive wealth transfer and transformation event. You know, these are just the most volatile pieces of that ecosystem, the easiest to get exposure to and the most likely to result in the most violent moves. Another interesting frame I heard was, you know, people thought crypto native gaming was going to be Axie Infinity, but it's not, it's meme coins.
Yeah, it's just buying. It's exactly. That's a great
there,
way
doesn't
to put it,
have
yeah.
to be any complication, right? You don't have yeah, to build a right. whole world.
You don't need to actually, be walking around getting paid to walk with a stepping app. You just needed, it's everyone that, was exactly. chasing the same thing. Yeah.
It's narrative. It's like, it's the narrative game. So it's the Bitcoin game, which is playing the 1,000-year narrative, and the meme coin game is playing the 2-day narrative or the 24-hour narrative. And if you catch the right one, like, it's, I guess there's an analogy there for all sorts of investing too, right? It's like people identifying things that they think are gonna change the world over the course of their family's lifetime versus something that you think more people are gonna find funny tomorrow. Therefore, there's gonna be more attention yeah. on it. Therefore, there might be more energy and money directed towards it. Therefore, you might be able to ride that trend a little bit. And it just feels like they're just more direct versions of things that are happening elsewhere anyway. Like the,
yeah.
oh, if you're on Twitter and you get 10 million people to see your post, you're going to make $20. Like this is just a more, almost a more honest version of that, you know? Like obviously there's incredible amounts of risk in like you, the chances that you're going to lose all your money is very high because you're yeah. also
well,
playing
I mean,
against
you're being
incredibly
honest.
Sophisticated yeah. You're playing against yeah. incredibly sophisticated people. And if you're not technically minded or you don't have like some technical advantage, which a lot of people do, right? Even in like, I can't even explain this, but the way in which you buy into these small cap coins, there are bots that exist that are able to like capture some of your buy-in just as a function of you not knowing how the market functions. So there's a tax on you for not knowing what you're doing anyway. But yeah, it hasn't stopped everything going apeshit because it's like, and people just having a good time doing it. You know, that's like, yeah. I think the vast majority of participation is driven by it's fun. Is it the most productive thing in the world? Likely not, but it is all downstream.
Like you said,
of,
likely not.
No, it but definitely. What I mean, to Jack's point though, what else on your phone are you, what are you doing on your phone that's actually productive, right?
That's so
like,
true.
There's a, it's just par for the course. That's why I brought up the like the DraftKings fantasy sports angle. It's like this is not even being critical.
Yeah,
I'm
yeah,
just
yeah.
saying, is this what this is? And that's totally fine.
That's 100% that. Like, and that is, you know, that like Barstool or whoever else, like their only means to sustainable monetization is a model like that now, which feels like it's becoming more and more true everywhere. It's like if you can't figure out a model that is like on the forefront of dopamine extraction,
yeah.
you're extinct.
Well, Howard Lindzen from Social Leverage, he says, he calls it the degenerate economy, which is true, right? It's like, there's a whole degenerate economy. It's like, if you listen to any sports podcast, Bill Simmons, anything from ES, guess what these guys are shilling, right? DraftKings. FanDuel. It's so I'm not saying any of this to be critical. I just want to, because I think the mainstream coverage of this will be quite critical, but they're just so in bed with these existing gambling institutions, right? Which is it's a joke. It's pure hypocrisy.
Trunk, what? Well, no, just to your, oh, sorry, Jack, just one thing I was going to add directly related to this. The founder of FanDuel, you're talking about FanDuel. He was on my pod, and I'm Nigel Eccles. He built FanDuel, is now, I think, a $10 billion company. Guess what he's building right now, right? The same guy.
Meme coin?
He's building, this is his bio. It says, co-founder and CEO of something new, co-founder of Vault Music HQ, BetDex Labs and FanDuel, meme coin trader. That's in his bio. And this is just funny because, I mean, he was basically building on Solana, just to come full circle. And And he was building originally like a music thing, I think, on Solana. But now I think it's like maybe a sports book on Solana. I haven't spoken to him for a little bit. But just saying, like, this is a full circle, right? Like,
exactly. That's what's going on here.
Yeah.
The NIA listeners came here for not investment advice, but we're trying to give you the 50,000 foot thing. Jack, can you actually just rattle off? None of this is investment advice. Can you just work off the top market cap names? I just want to hear how absurd they are. Because Dog with Hat is hysterical. Like, just as a name, I'm granting. I'm like, that's a good name.
I'll share the screen as well because I've got it open here if you guys want to see. But it's a pretty
hilarious. People, for the love of God, do not invest in any of these things without your own 100%. Research.
No, okay, go on. Honestly, in full transparency, I'd looked at my 2021 records and saw, you know, like the amount of, you know, like when you get the column of percentage increase or decrease, the amount of 99 to 100% decreases I saw last time round was incredibly embarrassing. But like I had at least five, right? Maybe five
or
six.
So Doge is back.
These are by market cap.
Well, Doge never left, man. Just in terms of like top market cap of a meme coin.
Jack, can you unironically talk through just the name? Just look at the list off the names. These are top meme coins.
Yeah, go on.
I'll read them off.
Go on.
Go on.
Okay. Dogecoin, 23 billion market cap. Shibu Inu, 20 billion. These are old school.
It's better when Trump reads it.
Pepe, 3 billion. So there's a big drop after Doge and Shiba, which were there last round, right? Doge and Shiba were the big
ones. They're like three cycles old now, I think. Okay. They've been around a while. Yeah.
So the big drop to Pepe coin, which also was around last cycle. Bonk sounds kind of new. That's a $2 billion coin. Holy God. I thought it was dog with hat. It's dog with hat.
Yeah, W-I-F.
W-I-F, people. And the
meme for that, have you seen the picture of this? It is, I don't know if you can, you can't click it here, but
the meme is
the hat stays on, if you haven't seen that.
And the hat stays on. It's Flocky. Brilliant. I love this next one. It's literally just called meme coin.
Baby Dogecoin, Mog, MAGA, baby. Trump. I mean, you can keep going on this all day, but.
Bone Shiba swap is $100 million.
Yeah. So Harry Potter, Obama. So I mean, there were a few screenshots I saw of like, you know, the amount of stuff which is literally just like famous people. It's like, what was it, Joe Biden, but spelt like Joe
Bowden.
What was it, Joe Bowden or something? Exactly. Yeah.
Geo Bowden. Yeah.
I backed up the truck for that one.
Yeah. Exactly.
I got in under 10 million on that one.
Oh my god.
Wait, what Jack, have you dabbled in any of these coins? Just no, don't say what it is, just if you have.
I mean, over the years, yeah. A little bit here and there, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I mean,
barbell investing strategy.
That's right.
Sound money and silly money, boys.
Yeah, exactly.
Sound and silly.
That's not mine, by the way.
You know that's coming in Fidelity's brochures pretty soon.
Exactly, yeah. Allocation.
Sound money, silly money. What else is going on right in the world? Let's crypto.
Maybe we move on to the edge. Unless Jack, you had anything else on that? Let's just quickly cover us on some of the edge of the internet, ordinal stuff, Bitcoin, NFTs, and then we can move on to the other topics. If you had anything to share there,
yeah, I could do a quick. Ordinal's been just massive narrative in NFT world. Like,
so what is Ordinals and how is it different to what came before?
So Ordinals are essentially NFTs on Bitcoin, but functionally they operate a little differently in that, you know, NFTs on Ethereum are typically smart contracts that are deployed that create tokens, right? So you have a smart contract, you say, going to make 10,000 of these. Here's a smart contract address and they're numbered 0 to 10,000, let's say. The Ordinals protocol is referencing this process called inscriptions, which is you literally putting file data on a Satoshi, which is a 100 millionth divisor of a Bitcoin, right? So there's 21 million times 100 million of these things, Satoshis. It's like a penny basically in the old system.
Yeah.
And you're able to put data on that individual unit of currency.
Yeah.
Right. And then this protocol or ordinals
refers to the sequence in which those things were inscribed. So they are sequential. So you have, I think there's around 60 million of them now, but they obviously started at one. Ordinal number two, or inscription number two, just sold for, I think, $1.5 million last week. Is a
oh damn, okay.
Cartoon parrot bobbing his head.
for people who are only listening, you gotta just click Jack straight to this on YouTube bobbing. Just to see the head. Oh my god.
Jack. I love that Jack did the head bobbing.
You'll see, you'll recognize it when you see it. I've seen it somewhere before, so I don't know where it comes from. But the and so it's now at 50 million, and there's been like a couple of collections that have stood out in the last couple months that take much of the like established social consensus around what makes a good set of collectibles on Ethereum and have just translated them over to Bitcoin. So there's like two or three collections that are like market cap wise in the top five across all chains. So it's just been a significant few months for sure. Like some of these are trading at 0.728 Bitcoin floor. What's that? 40 grand, 50 grand each, these 10,000 collectibles.
Oh, that's significant, yeah. Have you done, Jack, you've done stuff on Ordinals yourself, like your own collections and stuff?
Yeah, yeah, I have a little collection on there.
Is it checks or what was it?
Yes, yeah, so I did a checks collection back in...
so it's Magic... Sorry, go ahead.
Back at like inscription number 18,638. So this was last February. So before I did anything with this, like, or announced it or anything, I just got, I was working on the original version of checks on Ethereum and just did this at the same time back then, because, you know, if, you know, this is a significant piece of crypto art history, if this becomes a protocol that consensus forms around. So put 500 of these on Bitcoin last February.
Not investment advice.
No, yeah, no, definitely never.
But and just to say, you did that last February, so this is very much in the bear market. This is like a year ago, not
yeah. Before this is ago. Before yeah, before it was a thing. For
yeah,
sure,
when yeah. And you and obviously really, checks was really, you know, you were smashing it on checks at that point, right? That was like the height of checks as well, like when you had launched it and stuff.
And one of the things that one of the things that was originally like why this was dismissed, let's say, by the Ethereum community is because no infrastructure existed in the same way, right? It's like there were no marketplaces that you could buy and sell these things. There were spreadsheets going around on Twitter where people were like doing OTC trading in spreadsheets for these things, whereas like bid ask and people were like editing the cells of a Google sheet. And so people in the Ethereum ecosystem, for the most part, dismissed it as like, oh, this is stupid. It's like not as sophisticated. It's not going to work. And obviously, since then, all the infrastructure has evolved where you can there's user interfaces for inscribing. There's marketplaces to trade. There's like sites where you can set up a whole collection to be minted stuff. So basically it's starting to mirror the more mature Ethereum market. But in my mind, there is some narrative. There is an easier narrative in many ways because the inscribing on the unit of currency itself is an easier mental jump for people. And obviously the wealth that is stored in Bitcoin as a network, just that leap is smaller, I think. I think that's why the narrative has been so powerful with this is like, you know, Bitcoin is a $1 trillion asset and you as an artist or as anybody who wants to inscribe data on this thing can do it permissionlessly. If you own 1/100 millionth of a coin, which is obviously that in itself is not valuable, but you can add value to that by putting information on it. I did let me show you one more thing. Just did one visual explainer of this, which was this thing. You guys ever seen this?
Yeah, it looks familiar. Yeah, remember this.
So yeah. Warhol signed the dollar bill. I think this is in the
60s.
So
So you take this unit of currency that is fungible, and then you add something to it that is unique and it's non-fungible, right? Like the leap to describe this, I've found in talking to my parents and stuff, has been so much easier than Ethereum, NFTs, smart contracts. It's very interesting how it's like began as this, you know, unsophisticated thing, but that's actually, I think, grown to be its biggest strength, is that it, in principle, it's a very simple idea.
Yeah.
That's the update, boys.
And I'll say just again, with, you know, I'm not involved with NFTs really at all, except for the toads that I still hold from the last one, which are probably worth not much right now. But
historical
a toad is a toad.
That there you'll we be go. Good, man. That's
I hope that's, so, because that was not more money than I should have spent on a
generational crypto artist.
All right, great. That's good to hear, because I felt very silly for a while. But but I will say, yeah, even again, I see, like, I forgot his name. Is it Beanie? He's a guy on Twitter who seems like a pretty popular guy on in the NFT space.
Yeah,
he's been banging on about Bitcoin NFTs for a while as well, and I've seen a few other people posting about it. So it is quite an interesting thing where there, like we talked about in 2021, there was, you described it after going to one of the ETH events, you said like Bitcoin felt very much like Bitcoin, Ethereum felt like a religious thing. It was like you know, like I believe in one God versus
different churches, different schools
churches
of thought, for
exactly
sure.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And so it's interesting to see, like, now even like the Stacks guy, who we're going to talk about Stacks in a second, is like layer two stuff on Bitcoin. He's had a lot of pushback from Bitcoin maxis who are saying, oh no, Bitcoin should only be this pure thing. You don't want to have all this silly art on it and speculation. We just want it to be this one thing over here. And then similarly, there's the ETH crowd. There's an ETH maxi crowd, which are like, oh, this should only be on ETH, not on XYZ. So it gets a little bit silly, in my opinion. It becomes very, like, religious almost. But yeah, it is interesting to see, because if people are buying stuff at that level already on there, that is an interesting use case again.
Oh, it's crazy volume. Yeah. And the other thing, I'm not going to claim to understand the nuance of a fee infrastructure on Bitcoin, but this shit is paying for a lot of fees. Like, Bitcoin is traditionally a slow moving, you know, low transaction volume thing, and this activity is creating so much miner revenue, because you're moving tiny units around, like you're paying to inscribe data. And there's some argument, again, excuse my ignorance, around the, how the network will be secured over the longer term, if there's just like these big institutions holding huge amounts, and then there's like proxy transactions going on some layer two. This is costing you a lot of money to write to the chain itself. And
the
then just
chain,
like,
yeah.
This is maybe gonna come off a little nuts, but the fundamental idea here goes well beyond the, like, inscribing monkey pictures, right? It's like you can store information on this network and it cannot be removed. It's like an immutable record of information, like knowledge preservation, you know, the Library of Congress, whatever you want to draw an analogy to, is like the stuff that you can store forever and financially incentivize the preservation of, is another completely different thing that this ecosystem offers, in contrast to a lot of the other chains, which don't function that way. Like, they are records that you can trade, but to actually put the information on the chain itself and have every node in the world store it is not the case for every blockchain. So interesting to see it. And the other, like, just silly argument to go to sound money, silly money thing, is like the amount of people that have made ridiculous wealth on Bitcoin, have nothing to spend it on. There's also an argument for why there's a load of activity on that chain, and we want to get collectibles moving on there, because they've been excluded from all the silliness on Ethereum for the last 3 years, however long it's been going on, like crazy.
Silliness, yeah, yeah.
And now you can participate, have fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, you don't think BTC holders want to dabble with a little bit of fun?
So, it's clearly true that some of them do, yeah. And the issue around it being like shot down by the maxi crowd, that whole thing has been such a great boon for that ecosystem, right? It's like people just fighting over this thing constantly. It just always keeps it on the timeline. So these things I think are net positive for the attention on it regardless.
Man, Jack's 100%. Timeline over the past month, dude, yeah. It must have just been, honestly, you've been through so many of these different cycles past year. Has it been up there with like some of the craziest? You showed that volume chart just on the trading. What about the trading of memes? Has your brain just been like,
it's funny, yeah.
He's like, yeah.
But you know, 2021, like summer of 2021, whatever that was, that was just like
was
November
time.
2021. That was silly, man. Like, that you know, was, you boys remember that.
We haven't got to that level of silliness yet, but I think
we're
getting
so
there.
We're just so divorced from like the fundamentals of life
of
itself at that point.
Yeah, of life itself.
It was
itself,
just unbelievable.
Yeah.
That was unbelievable time.
Bro,
but if you look at that chart, like, if you look at that chart right now, it's like,
it could be even
what
more
are the downstream effects of that much capital
silliness
entering this ecosystem?
Yeah.
And it just finds its way to the edges and the madness.
Humor.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Let's move on. Definitely the last thing I want to talk about on, thanks for sharing that, Jack. Really interesting. I want to hear people's thoughts on that, on ordinals. I do want to call back to something you shared, I think 2 years ago. And I was texting you about this because friend of the pod, Tom Osman, has a Discord community for some time. He's obviously been on the pod, the famous one of our best episodes ever was the E for Rock episode. For people who didn't watch it, Tom, legend, he traded his way to $1 million E for Rock sale at the height of the NFT stuff. And anyway, he's got a community on Discord, Shiny. And I saw someone post on there, .btc domains, is this ENS 2.0? And there are a few people commenting on this, and in full transparency, Jack shared this on a pod, and both him and I had bought a bunch of these domains back in the day that were basically worthless. But it is interesting because remember when probably it's still worthless.
Oh, a bunch is underselling it to you.
Wait, Jack. Wait, hold on. I remember
incredible
Jack
ones too.
Bought an incredible. What would you buy? Like hope.eth. What was the best one
so
you bought?
Many.
Jeff,
no, this
was
.btc, man. I bought
.btc.
I can't even remember, man.
I bought incredible 300 domain, guys.
Can't even remember.
It was insane. It was insane. But but anyway, the reason I'm bringing it up, because someone had mentioned it then. I'm looking on Twitter here. So there is a bot that kind of shares like the sales of these. And it's not at the same ENS levels, but look, like milady.btc sold for 1,000 stacks, which is about $3,000 US. Mm. There's a few that are going for $2,000, $3,000. Miami.btc sold for $1,000. So like in the grand scheme of it, compared to ENS, like a Miami.eth would be worth what, like $50,000, $100,000, like a lot of money.
Right now, probably not that much, but
maybe
definitely
not now, but
few multiples. Yeah.
More of that either way. And that's what the person who had posted that, I can't remember the exact message, but they were saying, has anyone looked at this? It's interesting. It's a fraction of the cost of .eth. Could this be a thing, essentially? So it is interesting. I'm just mentioning it because it is on that layer two style thing with stacks. And I'm going to keep an eye on it because I'm obviously interested in if those random 100 domains or whatever we bought will ever be worth something. Pretty
Fuck,
funny.
Man.
All right, let's move on to the next thing. Trunk, MicroStrategy, Sailor. Let's
no,
finish
let's,
off the Bitcoin
I
stuff.
Think we got. Well, let's just skip that one.
Okay. Let's move on.
I don't want to talk anybody into investment advice because if I break that one down, people will be backing up the Brink structure.
Yeah, yeah. Let's get it going. Okay. All right. All right. Do you want to talk about Elon suing OpenAI instead?
Yeah, we could turbo through that one.
Go for it.
Actually, unless Jack really wants to hear the MicroStrategy one.
No, let's do that. Man, let's cap the episode off with the whole thesis, man. Come on.
Let's hear it. Trunk. Yeah. It's all
right.
Good.
Okay, so Blah, can you actually pull up the author of that writer? I'll walk through the thesis. So this is not Michael Saylor's thesis like that he's publicly made. I mean, he's made a lot of theses.
This is Zach Morris. No conflict, no interest.
Yeah, it's a Substack article. And full disclaimer, he owns BTC and MicroStrategy. He writes the entire piece. He's just like, this is not investment advice, for the love of God. Okay? So could you pull up, sorry to make you Jamie here, but can you pull up the market cap for MicroStrategy? I think it's 17 million now.
Yeah.
So Bitcoin's up whatever this year. What is it? 100 and bit percent. Maybe I think 110 or 120%. I think MicroStrategy's up 200%. So as mentioned earlier, MicroStrategy has basically become...
Their current market cap, it says, is... go on.
I think market it's about
21.
Okay, it's 21
enough. 21 billion, yeah.
Can you go year to date? What's the year to date? What's the year to date on MicroStrategy?
Let's see. Year to date is up 84%.
Okay, so it's outperforming Bitcoin this year. And just Trump,
could you do a 30-second thing of what MicroStrategy is for the few people who don't know?
MicroStrategy was founded by Michael Saylor during .com bubble. Late 99.
Friend of the pod.
Friend of the pod. So if you actually do a lifetime market cap, we should pull up that chart. But I hate to do this to you, man, but can you actually pull that up?
Where am I with doing this?
Just do lifetime, lifetime price market chart for MicroStrategy.
Incredible.
So if you, it's incredible.
Phoenix from the ashes.
It was a phoenix, bro. So, I mean, I'll tell you what it is right now. So for decades, MicroStrategy was effectively like an IT consulting type of business, IT services. That was what they're offering. And around 2019, 2020, when COVID happened, and Michael Saylor saw what was happening to Main Street, he made it very clear in all these podcasts that Jack Butcher made us watch, that what radicalized Saylor to Bitcoin was he saw asset prices explode during COVID because of the government printing effectively $7 trillion. So a quick pause on that backstory, but I'll pull up the chart here. So if you look at this chart of MicroStrategy, in 99 during the dot-com bubble, it was at about a market cap in 99. So not even inflation adjusted. So it was about as much as it was now, and then it completely
collapsed.
Around
2000, yeah, it looks like year 2000.
So, I mean, if you were to inflation adjust what MicroStrategy was in 99, it's like a $60, $70 billion company. Total.com came back down. And then back to the COVID Michael Saylor story, he saw the split that was happening from normal society and then asset prices. And then he realized that where the inflation was actually happening wasn't in the day-to-day life. It was an asset inflation. As in, people were getting these stimmy checks and buying the, but a separation between these SPACs, crypto, all these assets, everything's going up.
The Robin Hood stuff, like
the Robin Hood, Wall Street, all bets, that stuff,
etc.
So in his mind, he's like, it was no longer like, hey, we need to save money for inflation in the sense of eating food, buying gas, living your day-to-day life. It's like, as a corporate, as a CEO of a publicly traded company, the inflation that he was up against was asset inflation.
One analogy he used, he was like, I may as well go out every quarter and set fire to a pallet of cash.
Yes, exactly. He's like, what do I do with all this operating cash flow that we have, right? It's like, if I just leave it here and then my competitor or anyone else is putting in the S&P 500, I have to be hitting at least 20% a year, or it's useless, or it's worthless, right? Because as a corporation, if you're not reinvesting that money, it's in the corporate treasury. And Jack had mentioned early in this episode that him basically cracking the seal on making Bitcoin as a corporate treasury, like that, opening the Overton window on that is insane, right? I mean, Jack, that's what you were basically referring to. It was like 100%. He made the Overton window on making it acceptable. Because you know, with so many things in life, you just have, it's like the 4 minute mile, right?
First one that, through the wall, isn't it?
That was a 4 minute mile of Bitcoin as a treasury asset. Once everybody knows Robert Bannister broke the 4 minute mile that everybody thought was impossible, a month later, three other people have done it. I'm so happy we're talking about this now because we're getting into this.
Clip that.
Yeah, clip that. No, but so now MicroStrategy, people have been mistakenly saying that it's an ETF for Bitcoin. That's not what's happening. What it is, though, is it's a levered financial instrument for Bitcoin, because over the past 2.5-3 years, MicroStrategy has been issuing corporate debt at, when they did it, it was at a pretty low rate. They've been using that money to buy Bitcoin. So they are effectively a levered Bitcoin vehicle. And they're operating, the software operating business is like negligible now, right? It's just not the main event. This is not why this is a $21 billion company, right? I think, can we actually pull up how much they have on the balance sheet of Bitcoin? I believe it's in the 5 to 10 billion range. And he's up now 50% on that position.
Yeah.
But here's where it gets crazy. The article, I mentioned the Zach Moore. So now I'm going to try to walk through the logic chain of this article. But here's how it kind of goes. In addition to having a levered position on Bitcoin, because they've issued corporate debt to buy Bitcoin, which is what they've done, MicroStrategy is also issuing shares. They're issuing equity. They're diluting existing shareholders and selling out to the market. But here's the crazy thing. Typically, when you issue shares, the per share price should go, because people are being diluted, right? But so far, that effect really hasn't happened on MicroStrategy. So they're trading above their holdings of Bitcoin. And that holding will close. Like Zach Morris, writer of the Substack, makes it very clear. That holding will close. But there is a catalyst that's kind of just sitting there right now. And it gets very interesting with the catalyst. The catalyst is this. It's inclusion in S&P 500. Because MicroStrategy now is larger than the smallest S&P 500 companies. I think the smallest market cap S&P 500 is $15 billion. And then you have to have, for inclusion, you have to have I think it's 4 quarters in a row of GAAP profitability and some other kind of accounting milestones you have to hit.
Like, I love Jack's grin right just, now, by the
right?
way. Jack's grin, brilliant.
Wait, right. Jack, yeah. I want to know why, Jack, are you in your head, you're seeing what's going on here, right? Are you grinning
at the S&P 500 inclusion?
I just see like Trojan horse meme, you know, S&P 500 pulling the horse into...
You're seeing it, right, Jack? You see what's happening
here.
That's incredible. Yeah, hitting, I didn't know that.
They're like, Blau, you probably didn't realize that. They're hitting the milestone for inclusion. For any... Because
they're 21 billion, so that's larger than...
Their profitability requirements. So I see Bilal's eye just opened up a bit. He's like, Trump,
that's brilliant.
I need you to talk through how this. So here's what's going to happen, boys.
So Vanguard is offering Bitcoin. It's just in the S&P 500.
Guys, this is where it gets insane now. S&P gets to choose, right? They're still a committee. They don't have to include MicroStrategy. But the people are going to ask questions. It's like, listen, that's bigger than the minimum. They're doing everything that GAAP accounting requires. The inclusion happens, right? Okay. I think I can see right now. You guys know that beautiful mind meme of like of Russell Crowe, just a number? That's Jack right now. He's just like calculating what's going to go on here. So I hope I'm not butchering this. Once MicroStrategy is included in the S&P 500, every single pension owner of the SPY, the largest and most liquid ETF in the world, will be holding a levered Bitcoin product.
That's incredible. Wow. If that happened.
And listen, a lot of this depends on Bitcoin continuing to go up, right? But its existence in the S&P 500 gives MicroStrategy a vehicle to ensure the increase in Bitcoin. Saylor, well, he's no longer the
Jack's
CEO.
Face is brilliant.
Yeah, he's no longer the CEO of MicroStrategy, but they can keep doing equity issuances, right? They can keep issuing equity. And the dynamics so far has been, it has not been a sell-off after MicroStrategy issues equity and dilutes its existing shareholder base. Because what's happening is this. Michael Saylor is issuing equity, getting money into MicroStrategy. What are they doing with that money? They're buying Bitcoin. The price of Bitcoin goes up. Their holdings of Bitcoin go up. It's like a money machine. Do you guys see what's happening?
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to walk you through that again.
The fiat fan full conversion.
I have to repeat what's going on here, but I have to add the disclaimer. A, there's no guarantee they're going to get included. B, the the premium that they're trading above their Bitcoin will close. It, by the gravity of finance, it will close. It will somehow get arbitraged away. But I'm just telling you, hold up a lot before you ask it. I want to make very clear what's going on here. Once MicroStrategy is including the S&P 500, okay, it can issue equity. But here's the crazy part. As it issues equity, and then the ETFs are forced, they're actually reducing the percentage stake of the other companies as part of the S&P 500 holdings, because they're issuing, the way they rebalance the S&P 500 has to do with shareholdings too. So MicroStrategy is growing within the S&P 500 by the mechanisms of ETFs. So Jack right now is just like, what is going on? So I want to say it again. They're going to issue equity. It will increase their size in the S&P 500 because of how ETFs are constructed.
Jack's
they will take the money from issuing equity to buy more Bitcoin, which will increase the price of Bitcoin, which will increase their holding, their levered holding, which should increase the market cap of S&P 500. And it just goes in this fucking crazy circle. That's how MicroStrategy could potentially take over the S&P 500. But here, I just want to make it very clear. this has to collapse. I'm not saying collapse, Trung.
This excited since
I'm not saying collapse like it will implode. I'm just saying that premium that it's trading to its Bitcoin holding, it has to close. But this S&P 500 inclusion, the mechanics that could be involved here are just mind blowing if you just walk through it. So Jack and Bilal, With two disclaimers. Number one, this is not investment advice. Number two, I may not have gotten the exact logic train and mechanisms correct. Does this sound even remotely plausible? And how blown off are your socks right now of this implication? Jack first, because his eyes been rolling in the back of his head.
Oh man, I don't know. Just something that's incredible about like calling bullshit on the whole thing, you know? Like one of the things that was most interesting to me about the Saylor narrative when he talked about MicroStrategy was like, how are you supposed to even develop software to keep up with the rate of inflation? You know, like the whole like fundamentals of MicroStrategy were basically, I think he even admitted, it's like, we're never going to outrun that. Like we don't have the network effect or whatever it is. And to sort of call bullshit on it without exiting the system and like potentially having that effect from the inside is just the most incredible story ever.
No, I see what you're saying.
That's my take.
Hold on. I love what Jack said. Saylor on our very famous May 2022 podcast, like what was the last thing he said that we joke about here? It's like, what he said was this: if you're very good at one thing and you do something, or try to do a second thing, you will fail, because as soon as you take your eye off the ball in that first thing, every single arrow, somebody with more to lose that's hungrier to you, more to gain, will be working 24 hours a day to take that from you. I think what Jack, building on top of what you said, his point about software, and I just want to clarify what Jack's saying here, because he's 100% correct.
Yeah, this is good context.
Saylor's basically saying, I can run this IT services company that whatever does 50 million cash flow quarter. I just made a dummy number there, right? He's like, and he understands the power laws of software. Google, Microsoft, big tech are going to ultimately win, right? You can't out-compete them in resources, talent, and capital. He's like, it's a losing battle. I'm running just to stay in place. Mm-hmm. He's like, that for me, for MicroStrategy, it makes no sense. I love how Jack put it. He says that, and then he's actually doing something about it. He's pivoting the entire company, right? The same way Netflix went from shipping DVDs to betting the farm on streaming. I mean, I think that's a way to look at this. Saylor identified he was in a losing battle and just completely turned the ship around in this other direction. And obviously, the amount of criticism he's taking is incredible. I know a lot of people listening to this podcast is rolling their eyes. But like, we're just trying to tell you guys what we've heard and what Reed and Random Substacks
I think the first line of that article, and we'll share it, Rafa, we can share this, no conflict, no interest, Substack. The first line is, MicroStrategy is executing a speculative attack on fiat money by borrowing dollars and issuing shares to buy Bitcoin. That's kind of the summary in itself. And it's perfect. Yeah, I mean, you did a whole summary there, which is great. But and Trung, to your point, I'm just looking at the numbers here. In fact, I'm just going to share my screen really quickly. MicroStrategy this year to date, Bitcoin is up 52%. MicroStrategy is up 85%. Right,
because it's kind of what you said. It's a levered Bitcoin.
It's like a levered Bitcoin, and then
but it goes the other way too, right? If Bitcoin goes down, it will go down harder than Bitcoin.
It go harder, exactly. Yeah. So, and this is like you can see the last year. The orange on the chart here is MicroStrategy, and this is the Bitcoin price. So you can see they're very closely correlated.
Great pull, man. Great pull.
Yeah, and then but if you go back 10 years, you can see this is when he was chilling, right? Like, oh, you know, he's sitting there. And, you know, the scale of this isn't the best, but for anyone who's only listening, which is most people, you know, it's been a calm decade or two for him, right? Like after the hype of 2000, he probably, you know, still made enough money to become a billionaire, which he is. He was probably like out of the game. He's like, okay, I'm going to run this kind of semi-boring company. And at some point, he's like, I need to get back in the game. And the last 5 years, you can see 2020, 2021. Do you remember when he started buying Bitcoin on the balance sheet? Was that 2021 or 2020?
It had to be 2020.
Which makes sense here. Yeah. I mean, and then it just started really closely correlating this. And every time Bitcoin goes up, this goes up in price. So yeah, quite an interesting idea there, man. Very. I'm glad we covered it because we were about to skip and this was really good.
Yeah, yeah, okay, really Jack, how happy are you that for that fact then? I know we're running a little longer. Let me just turbo through Elon, OpenAI.
Yeah, then we could finish it.
I can see Jack being like, thank God. Jack's just, Jack, you're going to read that article now for sure though. Yeah?
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
Okay.
100%.
All right, let me turbo. Do you want to do, let's do a 5 minute or whatever on Elon suing OpenAI.
We've been covering history OpenAI a lot. So I'll just turbo through this. 2015, Elon finds OpenAI. Sam Altman, he was concerned about Google. We've talked about it before. We talked about with the Gemini stuff. We did a brief overview. He's concerned that Larry Page he thought Larry Page, founder, co-founder, CEO of Google, Bilal's former colleague, Bilal knew it was coming too. He was concerned that Larry Page was unconcerned that machine intelligence could take over human intelligence. Basically, Larry Page is like, that's fine. Like, that's how evolution works. Elon's like, you know, I like humans. And Larry Page called him a speciesist. Like, why are you preferring humans over other forms of intelligence? Elon's like, yeah, I disagree with that. So Elon started OpenAI with Sam Altman, who was a Y Combinator CEO at the time. And Greg Brockman became CTO of OpenAI. Greg Brockman was an early employee at Stripe. And OpenAI's job was to do counterweight to Google, Google's AI efforts. And Elon kicked in. It turned out to be the first $44 million, and was key in recruiting. I mean, that's the thing. Elon was obviously not who he is today, but 2015, he's a big deal in Silicon Valley. He helped recruit Ilya Sutskever from Google. And that was key as chief scientist of OpenAI. Now, Elon left in 2018, and from emails that came out, some pretty juicy emails. So for people who don't know, this is the lawsuit that Elon dropped last Thursday. He's suing OpenAI for breaching the agreement for the founding of OpenAI, which was meant to benefit humanity. And that lawsuit is charging that OpenAI is now a closed for-profit subsidiary, effectively, of Microsoft. So it went from a nonprofit, which was to share its AI and AGI effort research for the world to benefit humanity, into a closed for-profit subsidiary of Microsoft, which I think, you know, Microsoft is benefiting quite a bit from OpenAI. Can we agree on that? Like, obviously, we can agree that Microsoft is pretty hip-to-hip with OpenAI right now, yeah?
Yeah.
So he's suing them on that ground. And he wants basically the OpenAI to go back to its founding roots as a nonprofit that will benefit humanity. And the restitution he's looking for courts is for OpenAI to basically do that. He's not looking for money. And if he does get any money, it'll go to charity. And the disclaimer being, Elon has a competing AI product, right? He has XAI and he has Tesla. So like, obviously there's some competitive gamesmanship going here. But I think if you're just reading through his emails, reading through his background, it's like pretty clear that he is concerned about closed AI ecosystem, right? Ma'am, what do you guys think about that just as a setup? Do you agree with that assessment, or are you more cynical about the lawsuit?
And I've been following it from, again, I'm not following this very closely at all, but there have been a lot of these screenshots and like stuff OpenAI has been posting. I'm just sharing one on the screen. And I haven't verified this, so this could be a random screenshot.
Yeah, but I'll talk through it. No, this is accurate. So let me talk through this actually. So,
and then I've got a couple funny ones from both Elon and Sam Altman after, but yeah, go for it.
So Elon, effectively, OpenAI responded, right, to the lawsuit, which I just laid out what Elon wants. And the OpenAI also has emails, right? Like they're basically saying, Elon's not the only one with emails.
Trying to bring their own receipts here. Yeah.
So they showed these emails where it basically showed Elon saying in 2018, okay, we need to compete with Google. We're going to need a lot more than $44 million. Like this nonprofit fundraising is not going to get the job done because of compute, right? And he's basically saying, we need to roll OpenAI into Tesla. So OpenAI is basically presenting that as, look at this lawsuit, it's disingenuous, right? Like Elon's basically saying, 5 years ago, he said, roll OpenAI into Tesla. Isn't that for profit? I will address that because that is a fair point they've brought up. The other thing they brought up was an email of Elon basically saying, you guys have to raise billions of dollars. And like a couple million is not going to do the job against Google. So those two emails were presented in a blog post from OpenAI yesterday. They're looking to dismiss this case. Now, what I will say is this. It does look cynical from Elon's end, but what that blog post doesn't even actually really address is the founding mission. Is they're showing that Elon may not be 100% genuine in their eyes with his lawsuit, but it also didn't really address the larger thing. It was like, it's still a closed for-profit entity funded by Microsoft with the benefits of the technology going to Microsoft. I mean, that was the thing that jumped out to me from the blog post. So whatever you think about Elon's position, this is the thing that I take away from the entire lawsuit. It started as a nonprofit. And then created a for-profit arm, which is valued at $90 billion. And from the lawsuit itself, the key line is this. Would anybody do this? Why doesn't every company in California do this? Start off as a nonprofit.
You mean become a, oh, okay.
And then turn into a, well, blah, you work in the nonprofit space. So I'll actually ask this to you. There's clearly tax benefits to running a nonprofit, right? That's one of the big ones.
Yeah.
And the reason why is because government does want to promote certain activities, right? So, but the whole point is, if you're running a nonprofit, you gotta do like if I started
for social
a nonprofit,
good or like yeah, yeah, for, yeah.
If I started a nonprofit, which is an example they use to save the Amazon forest, and then you are able to get pre-tax dollars to fundraise that, and then you turn around and create a logging company, the government would frown upon that,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah. Or that, if you created a sports league that was a nonprofit is another way of looking at it. Yeah.
No, exactly, right? And which they've done. So Blair, actually, let me ask you about that. I think that's the strongest part of the case. But from the legal angle I've seen, the main problem with this case itself, it's not about Elon's emails or like back and forth. It's like there actually isn't a founding agreement. There's like a founding corporate document and some email communications at the beginning. That's what they're calling the founding agreement. But there isn't like a both sides signed everything. And like, if you break this, it's like
it's not like it was a contract. Exactly. But I guess the point though is what they're trying to make is that Elon, from what they're saying anyway, is that Elon agreed that they should go from a nonprofit to for-profit. Whereas for the last year or two, he's been saying, you know, as the tweet, he just responded to OpenAI saying you should be called closed AI and or like whatever. So no, but I guess that's what they're trying to
though.
Go on.
I want to ask you specifically on this. I think this is the strongest part of it, but it's not really illegal. It's more of a moral.
Yeah. It's more of an inconsistency. They're trying to call out as inconsistency, I guess.
Right. So what I'm saying is this. So if you're a California court and this case is in front of you and they ask Bilal, who has worked in nonprofit space, what would you think about this setup? You call yourself a nonprofit. And then you go turn around and you turn into a $90 billion company. And then all the investors, this is not what they signed up for. And you're not paying any taxes.
Yeah, that would be weird.
How does that perceive? That's weird,
right? I've thought that's weird since the beginning, yeah.
So yeah, that's what I would say. I think that's probably the strongest part of this lawsuit.
But I think two things can be true. And again, without me knowing too much about it, I could also say Elon has, for all his smarts and all the great things he's done as an entrepreneur, this does feel a little bit like, let's say he did agree, let's say that's confirmed, that he also wanted it to be a for-profit entity. And he was like, well, I'm going to be the majority shareholder. And, you know, fair enough, he put in all the money, right? Like initially he put most of the money. So I guess for them to then come back and say, well, now I'm going to like point fingers at you for becoming a for-profit when he agreed, that is inconsistent, right? And that's something fair to call out.
No, of course.
But
of course.
So I think both can be true here, which is, I still think it's a little, I haven't seen many other examples of people doing a non-profit thing and then becoming for-profit at this scale. I don't think it's maybe ever happened, because there's only been really one OpenAI. I don't know much more about it. But I will say, I do want to just share these two epic replies from both Elon and Sam Altman. So really quickly here, because I know we're running late for time. And for a little inside baseball, we're recording on Wednesday today. We normally do this on Tuesday. We want to get this out for you guys same day. So Rafa's going to be working real quick to get this out there. But this is... just, I think, from like the last day or two, Elon Musk responds saying, change your name to close the eye out and we'll drop the lawsuit. Quite jokes. But this one got a bit. Did you guys see this one?
Yeah.
This was a message from 2019. Sam Altman is saying, basically defending Tesla. And then Elon responds, thanks. And then last week when the lawsuit happened, Sam responds basically saying, anytime, with this emoji, right? And I mean, look, this is like, it's drama. It's kind of like silly drama here, but you kind of got to love it. It's pretty funny.
Got to roll with it. But let's pin it on this. Let's do Dune next week after I watch it.
Yeah, that sounds good. Yeah, okay. Anything else on that before we cut it off?
Great,
Jack,
man.
Any thoughts? I think that was a really good app. Good stuff, boys.
Oh, man, I'll try and get the IMAX Dune 2, right? Everybody's homework.
Yeah.
There we go. Well, have you guys even seen? Oh, actually, let's talk about next week. Hopefully you guys enjoyed that very heavy, obviously, crypto, Bitcoin, edge of the internet episode, obviously with Elon stuff thrown at the end and the sailor stuff. That was brilliant, Trunk. Thanks for sharing the sailor stuff. Very, very good find.
I love that, Jack's like, no, we should definitely do that.
yeah. Good pushback. And I hope you guys enjoyed it.
We need to get
Trunk
back on CNBC, given these kinds of
Yeah, 100%. 100%.
We have to do it.
Do you guys know the inside baseball, why I got blackballed from CNBC?
Because you said you didn't do your research or something.
No, because I tweeted that freaking clip and Trevor Noah retweeted it and it went viral. Trevor Noah retweeted that. I'm like, come on, Trevor.
Anyways, that's it. There we go. All right, boys, let's get this out for the people. It's probably going to be out hopefully Wednesday by the time you listen to this evening our time. But enjoy this and we will see you guys next week. Cheers.